On the 5th June of 1288, the Battle of Worringen took place. It was the climax of the Limburg-Worf succession, which we examined in the previous episode. The battle was attended by the who is who of the northwest of the empire. It is time to get to know them. So pause for a moment and look at today's map of our region. You see North Rhine-Westphalia, the Netherlands, Belgium. You see modern borders, railways, rivers and motorways, but imagine if none of that existed. Modern national borders disappear and even blur, and other power blocks emerge that have long since passed into history. From our present-day perspective, it would be a chaotic mosaic of dominions that hardly anyone is familiar with today anymore. That was precisely the situation here in the Rhineland at the end of the High Middle Ages. It is time we shed some light on this. The year is, as I said, 1288. On the Worringen Plain, north of Cologne, two mighty armies face each other. On this 5th of June 1288, one of the greatest battles of the Middle Ages will take place. This is, of course, not a battle of good against evil. It is about power and land, and money and influence, and the question who will dominate the northwest of the empire. Will it still be the Archbishop of Cologne or someone else? Today I'll introduce you to the key figures who challenged heaven and earth back then. Many of their realms have vanished from the map and are often forgotten by the general public or not widely known anymore. So let's take a look at who the key players were in the battle. On one side, the Archbishop of Cologne, Geldern and Luxembourg, against Brabant, Berg, the city of Cologne, Jülich and Mark. Never heard of some of these regions or principalities? No problem. That's why I am here. Who were they? What did they rule over, and why did they take part in the battle? Many of the dominions we are discussing today have long since vanished from the map, yet on that June in 1288, over 700 years ago, they decided the fate of the northwest of the empire, and on top of that, I'll of course try to track down some maps which will be available in the relevant post on thehistoryofcologne.com, and please pray for me. This will be a very complicated episode, and I did really my best to present it in an easier way for you. Let's begin. Let us begin with the most powerful man in the region, Siegfried von Westerburg, the Archbishop of Cologne. As always in the Middle Ages, when it comes to the Archbishop of Cologne, do not picture a kind and modest priest. Siegfried von Westerburg was a nobleman through and through, and as such trained in the art of war from childhood. He would personally take part in the battle at Worringen, swinging his sword and lance. Archbishop of Cologne since 1275, he was a power-hungry politician of the First Order, following in the footsteps of his predecessors, such as Konrad von Hochstaden and Engelbert von Falkenburg, to realize the vision of a unified territory stretching from the Rhineland deep into Westphalia. But there was unrest within his domain. The citizens of Cologne had had enough of his tolls and his lust for power. Worringen Castle in particular, an archiepiscopal customs fortress, was a thorn in their side. They called it a den of thieves that was stifling their trade. And quite a few vassals, who are actually subject to the Archbishop of Cologne, used the Limburg-Worf succession as an opportunity to claim more freedoms against him, the Archbishop of Cologne, at the expense of the secular power of the Cologne Church. This development did not, of course, go unnoticed by the Archbishop. Following the death of the local ruler, Siegfried von Westerburg had marched into neighboring Jülich to annex the county. Other vassals of the Archbishop of Cologne continued their policy of breaking away from his suzerainty. Leading the way in this conflict were the Count of Berg and the Count of the Mark. We'll come back to them later. So you see, contrary to what is often portrayed in popular culture, the Limburg-Worf succession was not a battle between good and evil. It was simply a struggle for power. The Archbishop's motives were clear: to retain the supremacy of the Cologne Church, which had been gradually built up over centuries. So, let's move over to an ally of the Archbishop of Cologne. Let's go to Geldern, which is far in the north from Cologne, and far in today's North Rhine-Westphalia and the Netherlands. One of the triggers of the Limburg War of Succession was that with the death of the last male line Duke of Limburg, the Count of Geldern named Reinald now laid claim to the title of Limburg through his marriage to Irmgard, the daughter and only child of the last Duke of Limburg. But where exactly was Geldern, and what did the territory of the Count of Geldern encompass? The history of the County of Geldern does not begin in Geldern itself, a small town today near the Dutch border, but in Wassenberg, an even smaller town 85 kilometers west of Cologne, also at the present-day Dutch border, in the district of Heinsberg. Around the year 1020, the brothers Gerard and Rutger Flermans settled there under the protection of Emperor Henry II and were granted lands and rights. That was the beginning of that dynasty. It was not until the 11th and 12th century that their descendants began to refer to themselves as the Counts of Geldern in reference to their holdings around the town of Geldern, which they had acquired in the meantime alongside Wassenberg. Over generations, their influence grew through shrewd politics and marriages until they rose to become one of the most significant powers on the Lower Rhine in the 13th century. Wassenberg and Geldern, those two cities and castles, remained their core territories. And in between, there were many scattered holdings. However, there was no single contiguous territory belonging to the Counts of Geldern, which is typical of the Middle Ages. Modern nation-states with contiguous territories simply did not exist yet. In 1271, the young Reinald I of Geldern became the new Count of Geldern. As he was not yet of age, he was initially referred to as a noble young man. Yet Reinald had great plans. From his estates in Geldern, his gaze turned southwards. He consolidated his rule in what is now Roermond in the Netherlands, a strategically important hub for trade, and thus a significant source of revenue from custom duties for his realm. The decisive turning point for Geldern came 3 years after Reinald took office as count in 1274. As already mentioned, Reinald married Irmgard of Limburg, the only daughter, indeed the only child of Duke Wiram of Limburg. A truly excellent match for Reinald, one that could catapult his county and thus himself into the highest echelons of the nobility and the empire. Because when Wiram of Limburg died in 1279, Reinald and Irmgard jointly styled themselves now Count and Countess of Gelderland, as well as Duke and Duchess of Limburg. Jackpot, right? Reinald had gambled and won Limburg. But his luck was not to last. In July 1283, Irmgard of Limburg, his wife, died, leaving no heir. Suddenly, the succession to the Duchy of Limburg was wide open again, as Irmgard's widower, Reinald, continued to lay claim to the Duchy of Limburg, but he was no longer alone in his claim. Adolf von Berg also laid claim to the inheritance of Limburg and promptly sold his rights to the powerful Duke of John of Brabant. We will, of course, return to the Counts of Berg and the Duke of Brabant later, the opposing side here. We had already covered the course of the Limburg War of Succession up to 1288 in the last episode. Unable to defeat the opposing camp led by Brabant and Berg and assert his claim to the Duchy of Limburg, Reinald sells his claims to the rising House of Luxembourg, who hope this will help them gain a foothold here in the Rhineland as well. And to round off one side of the conflict, let us continue straight away with the Luxembourgs. Ah, Luxembourg. One likes to think of Echternach, free public transport, and the charm of one of Europe's smallest countries. But we're not talking here about the modern little country of Luxembourg, but about the family, the dynasty of the same name. It was just really on the rise, and was still a long way from the heights it would one day reach, for example, in the 14th century, when members of the House of Luxembourg would even become emperor. Far beyond Luxembourg's present-day borders, it would go on to write European history. In the late 13th century, the Luxembourgs were still an up-and-coming dynasty between the Meuse and Moselle River. Under Count Henry VI and his brother, Wiram. Please, not to be confused with the late Wiram of Limburg. Why do they all have to have the same names, those noblemen in the Middle Ages? The Luxembourgs' gaze was turned northwards in 1288. The house was bound to the fate of the Lower Rhine through the closest of family ties. because their grandmother was Ermesinde of Luxembourg, whose descendants also ruled in the Duchy of Limburg. This kinship was now to become the key to an expansion of power, or to try that. For the Limburg War of Succession, which had been shaking the northwestern region of the empire since 1283, entered a decisive phase in May 1288. Reinhard of Geldern, who regarded himself as the rightful heir to Limburg, was financially ruined and military concerned, or cornered, better said. In this desperate situation, he turned to the Luxembourgs. A spectacular deal is struck between Geldern and Luxembourg. Reinhard of Geldern sells his claims to the Duchy of Limburg, to Henry VI of Luxembourg and his brother Walram for the staggering sum of 40,000 Brabant pennies. For the Luxembourgers, this is an opportunity to massively expand the territory. And actually, the question occurs to me, how much is 40,000 Brabant pennies? 40,000 Brabant marks in pennies. If a mark was a unit of weight back then, a Cologne mark, which served as the standard in the region, was approximately 233 grams. That makes 40,000 marks a weight of 9.35 tons of Brabant pennies. And pennies were minted from silver. And here the fineness of the silver is what matters, though at today's silver price, which ranges from 90 cents to 2.20 euros, depending on the fineness, what a word, that could amount to a value of around 8 to 20 million euros, or like 6 to 18 million US dollars. But before the history buffs start crying foul play, let me say that this calculation doesn't make any sense anyway, because purchasing power in the Middle Ages is something quite different from that in today's consumer and industrial society with a capitalistic economic system. I would therefore recommend a contemporary comparison instead. Shortly afterwards, the Archbishop of Cologne had to pay not 40,000 but 12,000 marks in silver. I won't mention yet the reasons for this to avoid spoilers. That's still, though, around 3 tons of pure silver after all he had to pay. This sum of 3 tons of pure silver burdened Siegfried von Westerburg, one of the most powerful and therefore wealthiest rulers of his time, to such an extent that he nearly went bankrupt and was forced to pledge several of his castles as security at the pawn shop. To cut a long story short here, 40,000 marks, or over 9 tons of silver, that is a lot. With the purchase of Reinhard von Geldern's claim, Henry VI of Luxembourg is now nominally also Duke of Limburg. But to assert this claim against the opposing side, he needs allies. He finds them in the former ally of the Count of Geldern, namely the Archbishop of Cologne, Siegfried von Westerburg. Although the Luxembourg possessions lie far from the Archbishopric of Cologne, the Archbishop of Cologne sees the Luxembourgers as the ideal partners. They are really powerful, enough to stand up to the opposing side, consisting of Berg and Brabant mainly, but geographically, the Luxembourgs are too far away to jeopardize Siegfried's own plans to become the remain the hegemonic power in the Lower Rhine region. In 1288, they decide to raise a joint army to force a decisive battle in the summer of 1288. So that's the situation in the summer of 1288. This side, speaking of Geldern, Luxembourg, and the Archbishop of Cologne, not the city of Cologne, that's important, they form an alliance and they prepare to have a joint army around Cologne in the summer of 1288. These three now form one side in the conflict. They aim to secure the Duchy of Limburg for the Luxembourgers. Luxembourg wants the territory again. Reasonable for them. Geldern has made a tidy profit from selling its claims to Limburg, though thus they are helping. And the Archbishop of Cologne sees this alliance as the best way to maintain his previous supremacy in the northwest of the empire for himself and his secular domain. Naturally, other rulers join this side as well. Most of them are vassals of the Archbishop of the or Luxembourgers, but I don't want to make it any more complicated here as it already is. These three are the main forces on this side of the two conflicting parties. So, shall we therefore take a look at the opposing side? Let's start by looking at the county of Berg, a domain to which we have already dedicated several podcast episodes. due to its close proximity to Cologne and a history that runs partly parallel to it. The territory of the Lords of Berg lay mainly on the right bank of the Rhine of Cologne, enclosed between the two large territories of the Archbishop of Cologne, bounded in the west by the secular possessions of the Cologne Church on the left bank of the Rhine, and to the north by the Westphalian estates of the Archbishop of Cologne. Conversely, this also meant that if the Archbishop of Cologne wished to travel from the Rhineland to his exclave in Westphalia, he inevitably always had to pass through Berg territory from Deutz or Mülheim. This led to a constant interplay of tensions, but also of cooperation in some kind of way between the two political entities. A previous high point in terms of cooperation had been Engelbert von Berg, who at the beginning of the 13th century was both Archbishop of Cologne and Count of Berg. Although the territories of Cologne and Berg had not been united, they were at least under the rule of the same person for the time being. You know, of course, how the story of Engelbert von Berg ended. He was brutally murdered in 1225 whilst traveling. This meant that the Berg noble dynasty had died out in the male line in that year. The Duchy of Limburg then took over. So we have a similar case here, which now took place 60 years later in the 1280s, who inherits a vacant territory. With the death of Engelbert von Berg in 1225, the succession dispute of the time back then came to an abrupt end. The Duke of Limburg took over Berg, and was henceforth also Count of Berg. When this duke died, he left his duchy of Limburg to one son and gave the county of Berg to another son. This gave rise to a new noble dynasty of Berg, which was, however, of Limburg origin. I hope you're still following. Whereas in 1225 the old Berg dynasty had died out and Limburg took over in Berg, the situation here is now the reverse. Limburg died out, and the Count of Berg, Adolf the Fifth, also laid claim to the now vacant duchy because he is a relative to the Limburgs. Being a Limburg himself, I mean his forefathers were. Thus, in my humble opinion, Adolf the Fifth of Berg also had a legitimate claim to Limburg, personal opinion. This was particularly true from 1283 onwards, as the Count of Geldern had, after all, produced no offspring with his Limburg wife, meaning he had no legitimate heirs. But what carried more legal weight now? Being related by direct bloodline to the last male Limburgers, as was the case with Adolf V of Berg, or having married the last living Limburg woman, as the Count of Geldern Reinhard could claim for himself before he sold his claims to the Luxemburgs? The answer to the question is pointless, for neither side saw the legal solution to this dispute, but rather a military one. Let's nevertheless take a brief look back at the county of Berg. It's been a while since we last covered this county. The history of the county of Berg in the 13th century is characterized by an intense struggle for power, territory, and influence in the Rhineland. Simply by virtue of their proximity and their close ties to the Archbishop of Cologne as his vassals, they are a family whose roots are deeply intertwined with the church and the nobility of the region. This is often forgotten by laying claim to Limburg, the dynasty of Berg, were thereby contradicting the wish of their liege lord, the Archbishop of Cologne, that Limburg should fall to Geldern. As mentioned, the House of Berg was no ordinary noble family. Between 1131 and 1225, the still ancient Berg family, together with its collateral lines, had already produced five archbishops of Cologne among their midst. This close connection to the Archdiocese of Cologne had been the foundation of their rise, but at the same time it was the fuel for a marked rivalry that became increasingly pronounced in the 13th century when the Archbishop of Cologne were not from the Berg family anymore. The former vassal was now becoming increasingly a rebel against his own feudal lord. I hope you can follow me here. In the second half of the 13th century, tensions escalated. Adolf V of Berg ruled the county of Berg with strategic foresight for several decades from 1259 onwards. That is to say, for almost 40 years. He seized every opportunity to consolidate his independence from the powerful Archbishop of Cologne, because archbishops of Cologne came and went during his reign, but out of the fifth of Berg remained and was able to pursue his vision of a stronger Berg territory. There had been friction between the Archbishop and Berg, particularly in recent times before the Battle of Worringen, when the king pledged the town of Kaiserswerth, along with its castle, to the Church of Cologne in 1273, alarm bells rang for Adolf V von Berg. And yes, Kaiserswerth, it is that very Kaiserswerth city, or town better said, at the Rhine River, where 200 years earlier, Emperor Henry IV had been abducted, kidnapped, as a child by the Archbishop of Cologne, Anno II. Do have a listen to the episode again if you've forgotten the story already. It was episode 44, I think. But what was the problem for the Count of Berg in this situation? The king gave a city, a town, to the Archbishop of Cologne. What's the problem? The king was always in need of money. It was perfectly normal for him, the king, to pledge his possessions, including entire towns and castles, to his princes for this purpose. The problem here, however, was that this was right on the doorstep of estates belonging to the Count of Berg at the Rhine River. Adolf V of Berg reacted immediately. He granted town privileges to the city of Ratingen, which was directly adjacent to Kaiserswerth in his possession. Good for the residents of Ratingen, and good for the Count of Berg, who thereby fortified the town massively. And it wasn't just Ratingen that was expanded. And dear people, let's pause here for a moment. Dear listeners, the time has come. After over 100 episodes, I believe, this city, the arch nemesis of Cologne, finally gets its moment of historical significance in this podcast, Düsseldorf. If any resident of the city of Düsseldorf is listening, please take it with a pinch of salt and a sense of humor. I like Düsseldorf. I enjoy visiting it. I like to go to the Japanese neighborhood and eat everything there. Yes, Düsseldorf. That's right. Adolf the Fifth of Berg wants to develop that little town too. Although he still has a long way to go there, the little village on the Rhine is exactly that. Just a little village on the Rhine. Not the big city it is today. But the Berg dynasty and the Archdiocese of Cologne had also clashed elsewhere in recent time. You'd already heard about it in the relevant podcast episode back then. Archbishop Engelbert II had died in 1274. The Cologne Cathedral chapter duly elected a new archbishop. The choice fell on the provost of the cathedral named Konrad von Berg. And according to his name, you might guess where he came from. Konrad von Berg, who must have been in his early 20s at the time, celebrated a huge success for the noble dynasty, which would thus once again secure the Cologne bishopric. Berg would be in charge of Cologne's bishopric again. But you know how the story ended. Siegfried von Westerburg, who had received just a single vote in the bishop's election himself, wrote personally to the Pope and ensured that the cathedral's chapter's election was annulled, and he himself, that is Siegfried, was appointed the new Archbishop of Cologne by the head of the Catholic Church. What a setback for the Berg cause. Konrad von Berg, the brother of the Count of Berg, did not become Archbishop of Cologne despite having won the election in the Cologne Cathedral chapter. So, let us be clear. There was a massive crisis between the County of Berg and the Archdiocese of Cologne. Berg found itself surrounded on almost all fronts by archiepiscopal estates. Even more so, there was fear of the Cologne's church's recent drive for expansion, as seen, for example, in Kaiserswerth. In the Limburg succession dispute, the Archbishop of Cologne sided with Geldern rather than with Berg. That alone can be considered the main reason for the hostility that would rise in the Battle of Worringen. Yet, the bishop's election of 1274 also shows that this was not merely a matter of power politics alone. Personal animosities were also at play, and there were scores to be settled. Siegfried von Westerburg had snatched away the archbishopric from Berg, after all. But Adolf V would not have reigned for 40 years had he not known full well that he and his forces were too weak to take the field against the Archbishop of Cologne on their own. Right at the start of the conflict, he made the very same move that Geldern would make. Adolf V sold his claims to the Duchy of Brabant. Brabant? What on earth is Brabant? And what claim does Duke John I of Brabant have? Short answer, none at all. Whilst the opposing House of Luxembourg had been distantly related to the Limburgs in some way, Duke John of Brabant had absolutely nothing to show for himself. It would be like, we don't have a mayor in Cologne anymore. The mayor of Amsterdam should become the new mayor of Cologne because he paid some money to someone. So, then as now, it was pure power politics, and pure power politics, as we know, will always exist. Let's take a look at the Duchy of Brabant now, which we have never talked about here in this podcast before. Where is it, and what made it so special? And why did Brabant agree to get involved in such a long military conflict? In the 13th century, Brabant, the Duchy of Brabant, was an emerging power in the northwest of the Holy Roman Empire, or was it in northeastern France? For this political entity, which had by then become virtually independent, wavered back and forth between the two great powers in whose border region it lay. The dynasty of the current Dukes of Brabant, whose roots lie in what is now Leuven in Belgium, has steadily expanded its influence over the generations. It all began in 1106, when Emperor Henry V enfeoffed Count Godfrey the Bearded with the Duchy of Lower Lorraine and the Margraviate of Antwerp. From this center in what is now Belgium, an ever-expanding territory developed, encompassing cities such as Brussels, Antwerp, and Nivelles. The year 1261 marked a turning point, some 27 years before the Battle of Worringen. Brabant nearly came to an end then, for in 1261, Duke Henry III of Brabant died, leaving his widow, Aledis of Burgundy, as regent for their sons, who were still minors. But there was a problem. The rightful heir, Henry IV of Brabant, was considered mentally and physically unfit to meet the demands of a ruler. I don't have really details on that, what that meant. Other dynasties had often been torn apart by such circumstances. Yet in a decision remarkable for its time, Henry IV of Brabant renounced his inheritance in 1267. He entered a monastery whilst his younger brother ascended the throne, none other than John I of Brabant, who in 1283 purchased the claims to Limburg from the Count of Berg. John was a capable ruler. He was brought up as an ideal knight, skilled in the use of weapons, a lover of courtly song and chivalric riches, oh my, what a word. Under his rule, which lasted until his death in 1294, Brabant experienced its golden age. But how did he achieve this, from the crisis of 1261, on the brink of destruction, to a golden age? Whilst other princes oppressed their own cities during that period, as, for instance, the Archbishop of Cologne attempted to do with Cologne itself, John promoted trade and forged alliances with the cities within his realm. Brussels, Leuven, and Antwerp were granted extensive rights and flourished. John I pursued a shrewd policy. He recognized that his power was closely linked to the prosperity of his own cities. In the late Middle Ages, this region around Brabant, and Flanders after all too, would become one of the richest regions in medieval Europe. The fact that Brabant entered the Limburg War of Succession in 1283 on the side of Berg, thereby turning against the Archbishop of Cologne, was pure opportunism. Because for a long time, Brabant had enjoyed a truly deep friendship with the Archdiocese of Cologne. They supported one another against enemies and respected each other's spheres of influence. But that was a thing of the past now. Meanwhile, John's ambition is stronger than ever. He wants to extend his territory further east. He dreams of extending Brabant's influence as far as to the Rhine River. This brings him into unmistakable conflict with the Archbishop of Cologne. Due to its size and wealth, Brabant is a formidable opponent. And when John of Brabant heard that the Luxembourgs, the Count of Geldern, and the Archbishop of Cologne were assembling an army in May 1288, the Duke of Brabant also set out for the Rhineland. On 25th May 1288, he arrived in Brühl, a town just outside of Cologne to the southwest. So there we have it. The coalition consisting of Geldern, Luxembourg and the Archbishop of Cologne form a joint army, and now under the leadership of Brabant, another army southwest of Cologne is forming, and those two armies will then inevitably clash at Worringen. As I said, far more rulers and factions took part in the Battle of Worringen, but these were the most important participants. However, I would like to mention a few more. Let's deal with those two quickly. Firstly, there was the Count of Jülich, whose domain lay directly to the west of Cologne. The Counts of Jülich had often supported the citizens of Cologne in their struggle against the Archbishop of Cologne. Foremost among them was Count Wilhelm IV of Jülich. He had even managed, with the help of the citizens of Cologne, to capture two archbishops of Cologne and hold them captive in his castle at Nideggen. However, he personally would not take part in the Battle of Worringen in 1288. For a shrewd, strategically successful and cunning as Wilhelm IV of Jülich was, so inglorious was his end. Together with a few of his sons, he was murdered by an enraged mob in Aachen when he was trying to collect taxes for the king. At that time, Siegfried of Westerburg of Cologne was already ruling as archbishop. He exploited the power vacuum and occupied large parts of the county of Jülich for a short time. This was not forgotten by, wait for it, another name of the same sort, the Count of Jülich named Walram, the third Walram now in this podcast episode, who had been ruling since 1283. It is therefore not surprising that Jülich sided with Berg Brabant in this conflict. The Count of Mark, Eberhard, also found himself in the Berg Brabant camp against the Archbishop. The County of Mark had once emerged from a cadet branch of Berg and had their center of power around Hamm and its Mark Castle, hence the name of the noble family Mark. In the immediate vicinity of the Westphalian possessions of the Archbishop of Cologne, the Count of Mark naturally had an interest in weakening Siegfried von Westerburg and helping his Berg family relatives. So, is your head spinning now? Yes, I believe so. So many participants, territories, names that sound alike, and motives as well. But there's one group, one important group we still need to discuss, which also became involved in the Limburg War of Succession at the very end. The citizens of Cologne. Listen closely. The citizens of Cologne, not the Archbishop of Cologne. He has been involved in that conflict for long now. But until 1288, the citizens of Cologne had largely stayed out of the conflict. In doing so, they had also remained faithful to their lord, the Archbishop of Cologne. As late as 1287, they had sworn to Siegfried von Westerburg that they would remain neutral in this conflict. But now that the Archbishop had gathered his army with the Luxembourgers near Neuss and the coalition from Berg Brabant near Brühl, the wealthy citizens of Cologne felt compelled to act. After all, two large armies were virtually right on their city's doorstep. Better to negotiate a little. But where did the delegation of Cologne citizens turn up? Not in Neuss with the lord of the city and Archbishop Siegfried von Westerburg. No, they showed up in Brühl with his opponent, John of Brabant, the enemy of the feudal lord. And what the people of Cologne decided there would change the history of the Rhineland, or nonsense of the entire northwest of Central Europe, but more on that in the next episode. Thank you for listening, and as always, auf Wiedersehen.